Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, March 28th. Governor Josh Green has decided not to impose a moratorium on short-term vacation rentals in Maui. We get reaction from Maui's mayor as some 3,000 people displaced by the wildfires are still in hotel rooms. We get updated guidance from state health officials, not just about COVID, but about other respiratory infections that are still going around and still a threat to the elderly and infants, as well as the medically fragile. Does learning pidgin first help you learn the Hawaiian language? That's research that's underway. And we wrap up our week-long pickleball series with insight from a pickleball pro and the only person from Hawaii featured on a pickleball reality show. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Governor Josh Green has opted not to institute a ban on short-term vacation rentals on Maui. He says 60% of the people in hotels have been connected with longer-term rentals. Only about 3,100 people remain in 11 hotel properties. The governor had warned he would institute a moratorium if not enough landlords converted their short-term rental units to long-term to help the local families displaced by the wildfires. We talked to Maui County Mayor Richard Bisson about his reaction to that decision to hold off on a moratorium.
I understood why he didn't impose the moratorium. It wasn't something of whether would I do it or would I would not have done it. I never sought that as an alternative for us. Instead, we used the incentive of getting property tax breaks for people who participated and converted from short-term to long-term. I think the big issue is none of us anticipated that people who were already renting to long-term renters would evict them in order to qualify for more monthly rent from FEMA. And that's been really the story of all of this. Is it's one thing to convert from short-term to long-term, but it was not, you know, nobody saw it coming that someone already in a long-term rental market would change out their tenants and find somebody who would pay them more.
Yeah, unintended consequence.
Yeah, unintended.
Well, and I'm not sure what success the AG has had, you know, with some of the complaints that have come in there. But the governor also said he is directing the Attorney General's office to crack down on the illegal short-term rentals.
Yeah, I think that's important, too, for, you know, supporting counties who are trying to. We're also wanting to crack down more and accepting even anonymous complaints about short-term rentals. Now, the thing is, you can't really prosecute a case on an anonymous tip, but the anonymous tip can direct you in a location that you can decide or determine, you know, through questions, through talking to witnesses, whether or not you can bring a case against someone. So the whether it's an anonymous tip or a named source, you still got to build the case for the landowner to determine if they're violating the law. So that's something we're taking a more aggressive approach on. And again, illegal short-term rentals don't benefit anyone. They don't benefit the neighborhood. They don't benefit the economy because they don't pay any taxes. And really, what they do is they take away from that neighborhood's ability to enjoy their surroundings.
Well, the governor also talked about backing off of trailer parks. The governor said that in the jurisdictions, you know, the city officials or state officials that he talked to, that they had misgivings about allowing those to be set up.
Yeah, well, we don't have a culture or a society of trailer park homes. I mean, that's just not part of our community throughout Hawaii. And so that was something that people were cautious about having done. Now, there are modular homes and other types of homes that people have started to come around to accepting. But I really think it's the quality, the size of these dwellings, the material that they're made out of, the workmanship. But I think if, you know, there are lots of people that have come to Maui to show their different, what they can offer, their different products. But I think ultimately it's whatever the homeowner can afford to buy that they think fits them. So even options, I think, are important.
The governor said he was impressed with the cleanup and the recovery progress to date, and then he was hopeful that people would get their permits, you know, if the infrastructure would allow them to hurry up and start rebuilding their homes on their land. What are your thoughts about where we're at with that?
Well, the Army Corps has cleared 409 properties as of our phone call, and about 70,000 tons of material. So they're working at a good pace, 7 days a week. They've been pulling long days, and that's quite a bit of material and property. So that's encouraging. And as far as permitting, we were standing up the expedited permitting office as part of the Office of Recovery. And, you know, we expect, obviously, by mid-April, we should be able to accommodate. We have already cleared the 26 properties in Kula that was cleared ahead of schedule, and we're already starting to review those permits that have come in for some of those properties where people are ready to rebuild. So it's different between Kula and Lahaina. As you mentioned, Lahaina is going to require the infrastructure be tested and either restored, repaired, replaced, and that's going to be decisions that we'll have to make. But I think it won't necessarily be whether there's an Office of Expedited Permit Review that will dictate people being able to rebuild in Lahaina. It will be more, is there infrastructure, is there water, is there electricity, and are the roads clear, and are people able to go back into their homes and areas safely? So there are a few things we have to consider before allowing people back into the impact zone.
Yes, and in your budget proposal, you did talk about a lot of the infrastructure that needs to be dealt with, not just on Maui, but the other islands as well.
Yeah, infrastructure is very critical. Doing the analysis, trying to figure out how badly damaged it was, if it was damaged at all. Are they the main lines? Are they the lateral lines that run from the main lines to people's property? Those are really important, issues for us to solve. And that's what we spend just about every day. There's, a committee on infrastructure is looking at all of this, whether it's our wastewater, whether it's our water, whether it's getting energy and power to places. Those are constantly being evaluated. And that's going to dictate in large part where and when we can rebuild.
Well, when we talked to Big Island Mayor Mitch Roth, we asked him what his priority was over the legislature, given that obviously the number one thing is Maui's recovery. And he said he needs to address the wastewater system because he can't keep kicking this can down the road. And I know that you have put in some requests to deal with making sure we're more resilient when it comes to fighting fires. And I understand that there was some proposal about using wastewater to help with firefighting there on Maui. I mean, is that something that you're looking at as you try and rebuild those areas?
Absolutely. We're looking at every possibility in terms of building our resilience, mitigating risk, increasing our preparation. So that's something that we're working on. Yeah, infrastructure is a very broad term, but in particular, getting water pressure to our fire hydrants and or standpipes that however it is, wherever the location is in the neighborhoods, those are important that we keep them not only filled with water, but pressurized so they can respond to that. And that's all part of the plan with the water department, the fire department, et cetera, to make sure we can address the volume that's needed. Now, we've also increased tanker trucks where we can bring the water to the fire, especially if it's more remote areas that are not closely, in close proximity to fire hydrants. So, we're looking at everything, but keeping the pressure and of course, R1 water or recycled water can be used, and it would be a great use to have it as keeping the pressure in the water lines for uses of the fire hydrants.
You have asked in your budget for, additional staffing, particularly in the areas of our first responders, right? Our fire, public safety,
yes.
That kind of thing. And everything else you need to stand up for this recovery effort.
So the 29 positions is what the chief and his deputy chief, approached me with, saying what each position was to be. I used to fill, including increasing on Molokai, so it's not all focused on just Lahaina or just Maui in that, even. So that's a big part of it. Mima has asked for 6 new positions, which I've approved, and that includes having Mima personnel on all 3, Molokai, Lanai, and Hana, the 3 rural areas. So that's going to increase our ability to respond quickly and get information to those communities. I think we also got a new public information officer and account clerk. Very necessary positions. The Corporation Council really has taken on a huge volume of responding to UIPA requests, also preparing for for lawsuits. And so there was some need for that. The caseload has increased tremendously. So we've tried to be very mindful of which departments we've increased. But our average, all the departments, except for those ones that had fire-related recovery, you know, increases, the rest went up about 1.2%. So a couple of them went down, some stayed flat. But our budget overall reflects about a 1.2% increase.
And something that just came on our radar recently is the situation about air travel to Lanai. Mokulele has asked the federal government to try and subsidize service there, and I guess that has opened up interest by other airlines. I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Well, competition can be good. It can make everybody be more diligent and vigilant in how they provide service to the public. So, you know, I'm not familiar with the specifics. I know on Lanai, in addition to Mokulele, that Pulama Lanai was starting or had gotten permission to be in the passenger service. So I think that's good to have options, even if it's two options. But I think it's healthy. And with this potential merger between Alaska and Hawaiian Airlines, who knows if they could also assist in adding some seats, some capacity. Waiting to see if anybody is causing any competition and therefore services to get improved over on Molokai.
Anything else that you want to underscore just as you sort through this next phase?
Well, I think, you know, this has been a significant wake-up call to all of our communities throughout our state. And on everyone's mind is resilience. And of course, how can we avoid a catastrophe or a disaster? How can we prepare for it? How can we manage through it and respond to it? And then how can we be resilient to it? And so I think that's a conversation we're all having throughout the state. And we've paid special attention to that here in Maui. And then again, trying to do whatever we can to promote housing and mental health, wellness, I think is very, very important and critical. So, yeah, those are some of the big topics that we are focusing on right now.
That was Maui Mayor Richard Bisson talking to us following the governor's news conference yesterday to announce that there would be no ban on short-term rentals imposed on Maui. Governor Josh Green had threatened a moratorium to get landlords to convert their vacation rentals into long-term rentals to help the Maui residents who were left homeless by the August fires.
Jonathan Haidt has a simple suggestion on how to improve the lives of teenagers. Phone-free classrooms.
You know, imagine running a heroin treatment clinic. And you say, okay, you're all heroin addicts. You can bring your heroin in, but you have to keep it in your pocket. Please don't shoot up while you're in the clinic. They can't do that. They're addicts.
What smartphones are doing to our kids. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Christy Nelson, author of Wake Up Grateful. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the transformative practice of taking nothing for granted.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
You know, we hear less and less about COVID-19 cases these days since the pandemic began evolving into an endemic. But it's still spreading, though the cases are far fewer than last year. We talked to Carolyn Pratt this morning. She is with the State Health Department's Disease Investigations Branch about the updated guidance, not just for COVID, but other respiratory diseases that are spreading in our communities.
So the new guidance that we're putting out is to align with guidance that CDC put out at the beginning of the month. Basically, the main change in the guidance is a couple things. First of all, they're changing it, and we are changing it from specifically COVID guidance to general respiratory virus guidance. So making the advice for COVID very similar to the advice for flu and RSV. Basically, instead of having to count from like your day that you tested positive or the first day of symptoms is day zero and then counting 10 days and all that, it's much simpler. Basically, the advice is stay home. Once you get sick, stay home until you haven't had a fever for 24 hours and your symptoms are getting better. And then you can do things for 5 days after that to try to prevent you from spreading symptoms to other people. So you can wear a mask around other people. You can, you know, try to do things outdoors, things like that.
Okay. And then just the usual hygiene, best hygiene practices, you know, wash your hands, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. So the rest of the guidance, both from us and from CDC, is things like good hygiene, covering your cough and your sneeze, washing your hands more frequently, absolutely getting vaccinated. You know, vaccines are widely available for COVID and flu, and for some groups for RSV even. You can still improve airflow, which is really easy to do in Hawaii. Open the door, open the window. And then also, we do just want to remind people that even though it's not required to wear a mask in most places, it still works. It's still going to protect you and protect others from spreading viruses.
When I walk around these days, I mean, I still do see a good number of people wearing masks.
Yeah, I think that people in Hawaii really care about their community, and so they do try to protect people. It's a great way to try to, if you're going to be around people who are, you know, kapuna or people who are at risk for severe disease, it's not a bad idea to wear a mask, or if you're going to be in a crowded indoor space.
Well, I remember all the warnings that we were getting just before fall about the concern with the rise of RSV cases, you know, particularly among the elderly or the fragile, and obviously indoors more, colder weather, that kind of thing. Can you give us any kind of sense as to how this winter has been?
Yeah, so RSV was better this year than it was last year. We had very, very high numbers of RSV last year. It was a little better this winter. And like I was saying, there are now, for the first time, there are immunizations available for some groups with RSV, for people who are older, for infants, and for pregnant persons. So those are all available now. The interesting thing about Hawaii, too, is that we don't have flu just in, you know, our winter. We have visitors from both the northern and the southern hemisphere. So we actually end up having things like flu and COVID throughout the year. So that's why it's always a good idea to get vaccinated and, you know, protect yourself with things like wearing a mask if you're going to be in a crowded indoor space.
Well, you know, I have to say the first time I heard of RSV, it was a 3-month-old baby that had come down with it. And, you know, very disconcerting because they're so tiny, so little. And, it was very worrisome for the parents with this newborn.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of the groups that's at higher risk. Most adults have had the RSV at some point in their lives, and so we might just have very mild or no symptoms if we're exposed to it again. But it is those really young infants who just don't have fully developed immune systems who are at risk for getting really sick and having to be hospitalized. So that's why there's new recommendations for getting infants and pregnant persons vaccinated.
Okay, and as far as the vaccinations for RSV, I mean, any bad side effects with that?
I'm aware of. I can ask my colleagues in immunizations, though.
What can you tell us about the snapshot of COVID cases?
Yeah, so we are still seeing COVID cases. Our rates have actually been going down the last couple weeks. We still are tracking COVID, but one of the reasons for this new guidance and why it's, you know, feasible at this time is that hospitalization rates and mortality rates are so much better than they were 2 years ago or even 1 year ago. We have more tools now with vaccines and with treatments like antiviral treatment. So especially people who are at high risk for getting severely ill, if you are sick, it's a good idea to get tested for COVID or to see if it's COVID or flu, because there are antiviral treatments that are available from your medical provider.
Yeah, and if I recall, you know, we, I think, surpassed the 2,000 mark on the cases of COVID fatalities, but lots of folks are still getting ill and ending up, you know, in the hospital if they're medically fragile.
Yes. So even though you know, mortality and hospitalization rates are a lot better. People who are at risk for severe disease are still at risk. So, you know, the kapuna, people who have other severe medical problems or immunocompromised, they're definitely still at risk. And that's why one of the reasons we included on our guidelines on our website, what do you do if you're someone who's at higher risk for severe disease? So we definitely included all those specific immunizations recommendations, because there are specific recommendations for people who are older or immunocompromised. And then again, things like things you can do, like masking if you're going to be in a crowded indoor space. If you do get sick, for people who are at risk for severe disease, for a lot of us, you know, at this point, you know, we're going to stay home, have cold-like symptoms, flu-like symptoms, and just get better. But if you're someone who's at risk for severe disease, it's actually really good to know what you have. Do you have flu? Do you have COVID? Do you have RSV? Because especially for flu and COVID, there's antiviral medications that your doctor can prescribe.
Yeah, well, I lost my voice and got tested, and they said it was none of the above. It wasn't RSV. It wasn't COVID. It wasn't the, you know, influenza A or B, because I've been vaccinated. But yeah, there's always all kinds of stuff out there, you know, your garden variety viruses, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. There's still, you know, other respiratory viruses are still out there. But the recommendations that we in CDC have for COVID, flu, and RSV apply for all those too. You know, wearing a mask is still going to help, even if it's just a cold.
Refresh our memory as far as then COVID vaccines, if you've gotten the boosters, is there additional guidance coming out on that from the CDC?
Yeah, so definitely want to encourage anyone who hasn't gotten the new vaccine that came out in September of last year. But only about 12% actually of people living in Hawaii have gotten that. And we really, really recommend everyone get that one. It's the most up-to-date it's going to cover for the current variants that are going around.
Can you tell us which variants are most prevalent now?
The last I've heard, JN1 is one of the variants going around, but based on everything we've seen so far, the vaccine, the most up-to-date vaccine, is effective against it, and as are the antiviral treatments. And we're not seeing at this point where this variant isn't any more severe than other ones. It's very transmissible, so easy to pass to other people, but it's not making people more sick than past variants have.
Okay, so it might be a little bit more contagious, but we aren't seeing the fatalities like we did early
Correct.
On in this pandemic. And it's now an endemic, so it's something we just have to live with.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's likely, CDC hasn't come out with this guidance yet, but it's likely that your COVID vaccine will become like your flu vaccine, where you get a new dose every year.
Anything else that you think would be important to underscore for our listeners? Yeah, I guess the fact that it's not just winter that we have to worry about getting sick, but, you know, year-round.
Yeah, because Hawaii has so many visitors, we do have to worry about year-round. The other thing I would just add is that people in Hawaii are so great about caring about their community. They really care about their own health and the health of those around them. So if you are somebody who's either cares for somebody who is at higher risk or just know you're around people with higher risk, definitely make sure you're vaccinated. You know, stay away from those high-risk people if you do get sick. Wear a mask if you're going to be around them closely. All those things are still effective.
Good reminders. But thank you so much for your time today.
Great. Thank you.
That was Carolyn Pratt. She's the branch chief for the Health Department's Disease Investigations Unit. She was giving us the latest guidance for respiratory diseases, including COVID-19.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's Daikin, at CostcoHawaii.com.
HPR is hiring a membership manager. This position oversees HPR's monthly giving program and the overall HPR donor experience, including direct mail, broadcasts, and online platforms. Join HPR's growing and passionate team. Apply by March 31st. Find a position description and salary information at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Support for HPR comes from Mobi, a Hawaii wireless company serving the island since 2005, committed to providing personal service to each customer, featuring a locally based customer care team. Learn more at mobi.com.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We'll be wrapping up our pickleball series later in the show, so we thought we'd test your knowledge of what some might consider a similar sport, tennis. One of the first people inducted into the U.S. Tennis Association's Hawaii Pacific Hall of Fame was Robert Keaunui, affectionately known by many as Coach Bob. Keaunui was born in Lahaina in 1936. He learned to play tennis from the beloved Shigeto Wakita, who taught a generation of kids spanning all ethnic, economic, and social backgrounds. Keaunui served in the Army for 20 years before becoming a tennis coach and bringing Wakita's No Child Left Behind philosophy to Windward Oahu. Kids came in droves to Kailua, Waimanalo, Kahalu, Haula, and Kaneohe District Park to take lessons from him. He taught them whether they could pay or not, and often provided them with equipment and rides. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name that Keaunui's youth teams were affectionately known by? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. First one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Speak pidgin? Could it be that it could give you a leg up if you want to learn the Hawaiian language? Well, that's the subject of new research underway. Here to talk about it is HPR reporter Ku'uwewe Hirishi. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Pidgin, the English-based Creole language that emerged from the island's plantations back in the 19th century, is spoken, and I was a little surprised by this, by more than half of the population in Hawaii. That's according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. So this got Michelle Kamigaki Barron thinking. The Honolulu native and Roosevelt High School grad is currently a PhD student in linguistics at the University of British Columbia. She'd learned the similarities between Pidgin and Olalo Hawaii. These include in vocabulary, so Hawaiian words that were adopted by Pidgin, like the word po, which means finished. Are you pa with that? There are similar sentence structures as well. Kamigaki Barron shared that example in the story Ono Dalaula. Ono Kalaulau, which would sort of be the Hawaiian version of that, which doesn't work for English. You can't go, you know, to an English speaker and say, delicious, the lolo. They're a little perplexed by that. But in pidgin and in Hawaiian language, the sentence structures fit. So she wanted to explore these similarities a bit more. She actually moved to Canada to study with linguists like Jen Hay, who published a similar study comparing Maori and Maori-accented English.
Jen Hay was one person who found that basically people who just spoke English in Aotearoa had different degrees of just innate knowledge of Maori, but none of these participants that she had even studied Maori before. So they're all just kind of picking it up because there's, you know, TV shows or in different kinds of cultural kind of demonstrations or, you know, at the airport when they speak. And because of that, they found that they were able to sort of perform just as well as Maori speakers, fluent Maori speakers on certain tasks.
Oh, so it's like what, nuances, cues?
It's a lot of, you know, with all the similarities there in Olelo Hawaii and Pidgin, I think that just translates easily into, right? Same thing for Maori and English and Maori-accented English. Kamigaki's Barons Project takes these similarities a step further to see whether they could be harnessed in some way to give Pidgin speakers, as you mentioned earlier, an advantage in learning Olelo Hawaii, where it can be utilized in a classroom setting, perhaps, or in an app like Duolingo. She's especially interested in using this study to underscore the value of Pidgin to help it sort of shake that stigma of somehow being an inferior language with little to no value. Kamigaki Barron says the study was actually inspired by her grandfather, Tadashi Yoshida, a trilingual fisherman from Honaunau. Despite speaking Japanese, Hawaiian, and Pidgin, she says her grandfather wasn't considered quote-unquote smart by Western colonial constructs.
You know, our kupuna did not really necessarily learn languages back in the day to be, you know, show off or be like, I'm smarter than you. But really, it was about community building and just having good relationships with people. And I think about that a lot because Pidgin has a lot of value in our society and always has, you know, like for our ancestors, it was really hard to communicate right after all these languages. You know, Hawaiian was banned at that time. There were all these people coming from different places. There was just a lot of discrimination from the Americans that were saying, okay, if you speak this language, that's bad. This one, you know, you have to kind of prove yourself as being American. So it was survival to speak Pidgin as well as it was to talk to people from different ethnic groups and different language backgrounds.
Just makes sense, yeah.
It does. UH Hilo Hawaiian language professor Larry Kimura, often referred to as a grandfather of Hawaiian language revitalization, says, you know, yeah, there are minor similarities between Olelo Hawaii and Olelo Pa'i'ai, so the Hawaiian word for Pidgin, meaning sort of language that, like Pa'i'ai, is sort of slapped together. But he says the Pidgin of today has evolved from its plantation roots. And even before that, Olelo Hawaii actually had its own Pidgin language. I don't know much about this. Maybe a study perhaps is needed in that area. But the Pidgin being studied by Kamigaki Barron is a language that sort of emerged when English began to become the dominant language here in Hawaii. But I visited a Hawaiian language class earlier this week, Hawaiian Language 201, taught by UH Manoa Hawaiian language professor Ali Rosette. And over the last 14 years of her teaching at UH, Rosette says she regularly uses Olelo Pa'i'ai to engage her students. If students grew up in a Pidgin-speaking household, she says then she wants to encourage them to forge a relationship with Olelo Hawaii through Pidgin, because there are those similarities. But Rosette says, you know, the two languages are completely different in origin. Pidgin was developed during the plantation era, as Kamigaki Barron mentioned, out of necessity, and not to mention under the pressures of American assimilation. You know, she says, Rosette says, it had a purpose fit for the time. But Olelo Hawaii, on the other hand, is a language that has evolved here in the islands for centuries, and teaching students Hawaiian language helps them forge a more authentic connection to Hawaii, its history, its places, and its people. Kamigaki Barron says, you know, it isn't her intention to have Pidgin replace Hawaiian language necessarily in classrooms, but if More than half of the population in Hawaii speak Pidgin as their first language, and Pidgin speakers can learn Hawaiian faster, then why not sort of explore that? This is an ongoing study, and I didn't get to mention this in the story that aired earlier today, but Kamigaki Baron is still looking for participants for the online study, mainly Olelo Hawaii speakers who also speak Pidgin, to sort of get into the similarities of the two languages and see if it is a little easier for folks to pick up Hawaiian language, but also for speakers of any language who may have had exposure to Pidgin. She wants to kind of uncover what that means, if there's any value to it that perhaps hasn't been looked at by other researchers. Right now, there's no sort of end date on it. This is her dissertation for her PhD. So we shall see what comes of the results.
Okay, so I'm curious, did you grow up speaking Hawaiian or did you learn it later?
Hawaiian. I learned Hawaiian in immersion at age 5. Yeah. Wow. So it wasn't my first language. I was exposed to it, and as much as I think Pidgin as well in the household amongst friends growing up. And I can find myself, every, I think, resident out there, an Olelo Hawaii speaker knows this. You can sort of switch, right? Code switch between the two and three, including English languages. But for me, it's sort of innate. If somebody's talking to me in Pidgin, I'll respond in Pidgin, but if they're not, I won't jump into it too much.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, because I didn't grow up learning my language tomorrow, and my parents remember distinctly saying, well, we're not going to teach you. We're going to teach you English. You need to learn English because you're under the Americans now, and, right. And you'll pick up the language later. And, you know, I mean, I can pick up, you know, some Chamorro words here and there, and I did study it in class, and I just got my hands on a brand new Chamorro dictionary. Yes, so I'm real interested to kind of pick that up again, but it is just curious to see how, you know, similar we are in, you know, you don't grow up learning it, really, right. But then you do pick it up later.
And there's a lot of meaning there, and I think that's part of what she's going to uncover in her study. But you should join this. I'm sure you had some exposure to Olelo Pa'i'ai or Pidgin. I'd be interested to hear you speak Pidgin, Catherine.
Small kind.
Love it. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was HPR's Ku'uwe Hirishi. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Nancy Nichols talks about American women and cars, which she says became our most gendered technology. Women weren't considered qualified to drive cars, but they were used to advertise them. Cars were mostly designed for male bodies, she writes, in ways that put women drivers at risk. Her book is Women Behind the Wheel. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Do you have an accounting or billing background? Would you like to put your skills to use for HPR? We're offering a part-time accounting position. If you're community-minded and love HPR, this may be just the job for you. We offer a hybrid work schedule and a collaborative and friendly team. Please send your resume and cover letter by April 15th. Pay range and more at hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs.
Now it's time to serve the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier we asked you about Hall of Fame tennis coach Robert Keaunui. Coach Bob first earned his title after retiring from a 20-year career in the Army. After settling down in Windward, Oahu, he shared his love of tennis with the community, offering lessons and helping to build the sport. His adult teams were known as Bob's Angels and were a big part of Oahu tennis leagues for 20 years. But while he helped to guide and coach many adults, his primary focus was sharing his love of tennis with children. They came in droves to several Windward Oahu parks, from Waimanalo to Haula, to take lessons. His children's teams were famously known as Bob's Mobs, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. Keaunui leaves a legacy of thousands of grateful players and parents, and one of those was our winner today, Paul from Kaneohe, who was a member of Bob's Mob. And I love when that happens, when our listeners have a connection to our backyard quiz. Thank you so much for playing, Paul. Well, that's our quiz, and if you have an idea for one, write to Talk Back at hawaiipublicradio.org. Imagine getting paid to play pickleball. Well, a national call for elite pickleball players went out last fall for the reality television series Pickleball Paddle Battle. Now, 16 contestants will paddle their way to the top prize, a professional sponsorship. Here's Iolani alum Ace Rodriguez, founder of the indoor pickleball company Pickleball Kingdom, and he's the producer of this series.
Teammates, we just concluded an exhaustive review of all applicants for season one of Pickleball Paddle Battle. To put that in perspective, we had 93 entries on the last day alone. Crazy, right? So first of all, big mahalo to all of you who entered. I gotta tell you, some of you have no idea how close you came to being selected. So keep an ear out for season two, might be you. But to let you know what we have for this season, we've got elite players with some big personalities and cool background stories. Just to give you a flavor, we have an American Ninja Warrior. We have an attorney. We have a triathlete. We have a nurse. We got a couple of pro tennis players. We even have a TV newscaster. It's going to be great. We're definitely going to make magic happen.
And today we hear from one of those elite players, the only Hawaii resident to be cast in Pickleball Paddle Battle, which wrapped up production this past November. Kevin Wong's a champion in the local pickleball community and known affectionately as the Trick Shot Maestro. The conversation's Lillian Song sat down with Wong in our studio.
It's interesting to see how Pearl City native Ace Rodriguez married the popularity of pickleball and reality TV with the creation of Pickleball Paddle Battle, which you successfully applied for and made onto the cast, one of 16. Share details about that.
Yeah, I was super excited to be announced as one of the final 16, one of 8 men that were able to get onto the show. It was a great time. It was fun to compete on the show and to be able to meet new people, and it was just a blast to be on it.
It hasn't aired yet, but how did you play pickleball for a reality TV show?
Yeah, thankfully, it was mainly about pickleball, not so much the reality side of it. And so it was mainly just competition, whether it be gender doubles, mixed doubles, some things here and there that you'll see. But it was mainly through competition that we kind of went about the show.
Okay, and what's the status of the show at this point?
Currently, I think they are still working on finding a network. I don't have any details on any release date or anything like that, so stay tuned. Hopefully this year it'll come out, but nothing certain at this point. I grew up playing tennis pretty much my whole life, since I was 7 all the way through college, so I haven't touched a racket for about 10 years now, and it's been mainly pickleball. About 2017, it's when I first picked up a paddle. I definitely do see both sides, even though I'm on more of the pickleball side these days. But I definitely can relate to both sides in terms of not having enough court space and just kind of wanting both pickleball and tennis players to be happy.
Right, right. And while doing the research, your name came up quite a bit. So you're well known in the circles of pickleball.
Apparently. Thank you.
So how did you fall into and start pickleball?
One day, a bunch of guys from church asked if I wanted to go play pickleball. At the time, I had no idea what pickleball was, never heard of it, never seen it before. They said it's a racket sport. It's kind of like tennis and ping pong. And I love both of those. And I played both of those. So I was like, okay, let's go hang out. Let's go have some fun. Went out there and been playing it ever since.
So fast forward 7 mm-hmm. years. You are now a pickleball pro at Wildlife Country Club. So help me understand, what does it take to get to the level of being paid to play pickleball?
The route that I'm currently on is not playing professional pickleball in terms of going to tournaments and playing for prize money that way. I'm currently teaching and instructing here in Hawaii, pretty much part to full time right now. And that's the path that I'm on and kind of what it takes in terms of getting paid to play or getting paid to teach pickleball.
Pickleball in itself is very unique. You said it was a merge of tennis and ping pong, and there's a thing called the dink and the kitchen. Care to, like, what was your reaction when you first heard these terms?
Yeah, I mean, definitely early on, these terms, even the name of pickleball is just pretty funny to think about. And so thinking of dink and the kitchen, to me now, though, it's just common. I mean, it's just the terms that I use day in and day out when I'm teaching or playing. So it's definitely interesting early on, but now it's just a day-to-day thing that I'm used to.
Because you're already like a 5.0 level player, how much practice do you put in?
Sure. I honestly probably play maybe one, maybe two times a week if I'm lucky. The majority of time that I'm on court is teaching. So not as much as some people think. Yeah, probably like one to two times a week.
I see. Different aspects of a career in pickleball. You could totally just be playing like tournaments, playing for prize money. But like in your case, what you're doing, you're making it a career by teaching, by coaching pickleball.
Yes, correct. One of the highlights of teaching pickleball is seeing, number one, just the love of the sport that others also can see as they're practicing or improving and just playing the sport of pickleball. Whenever someone learns a new shot or gets excited about being able to keep a rally going, that keeps me motivated to continue teaching, to continue helping others to play pickleball and to get better.
There is also an organization like a pro circuit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a couple pro circuits, the PPA Tour and the APP Tour, and also a thing called Major League Pickleball. And these are all professional tours that players travel to across the states and play mainly for prize money. And so those are the avenues in which players are playing professionally.
Okay, and do you follow like what's happening on the continent with tournaments and the leagues and all that?
Yeah, I definitely follow what's happening across pickleball, especially the pro tournaments. Social media makes it very easy to follow, so I'm following along when there are tournaments.
As you see the popularity growing, do you anticipate pickleball achieving the stature of sports like, say, the NFL, where you're going to have Super Bowl for pickleball?
Yeah, I mean, I think pickleball is still in its early stages, and I think it does have the potential to make it big. I'm thinking hopefully it makes it to the Olympics one day. In terms of the Super Bowl, hopefully there's maybe like a big year-end tournament. They only take the top like 8 players at the end of the year type of thing.
So very elite. Okay.
Yes. But hopefully it just continues to grow in that way. Currently, there are some tournaments here locally. They're not big tournaments. They're on the smaller side, mainly local. I would say there's maybe 2 or 3 tournaments that bring in players from all over. Recently, at the beginning of the year, was the one in Maui in January. And then the Hawaii Open, that was just in February, that I was able to participate in, and that brought some pro players down. Otherwise, you're not looking at too many tournaments here in Hawaii. There are maybe 1 or 2 leagues that are happening. I think the biggest is probably Oahu Pickleball Association runs a league at Diamond Head. But other than that, not too much on the competition side of things.
I see. And as a spectator sport, do you see pickleball like achieving? Is it being picked up by OC16? I mean, locally, do people get to watch pickleball getting played?
In Hawaii, I don't think there's many, if any, stations that are picking up pickleball matches. I just don't think there's a big enough venue for it at this point. Hopefully in the future, organizations and things can put on bigger events where people can come and watch really good pickleball being played. But currently there's nothing in terms of like volleyball being played on OC16 or even basketball or even high school sports. So currently that's not happening.
Okay. And before I let you go, though, any other things you think would be helpful for our listeners to know? Anything you'd like to share about just your journey with pickleball?
Yeah, I think if you've never played pickleball before, I think it's a great sport and a great time to try it. There's many places to play, and there's courts that are being built across the island, across the state. So check it out. If you do play pickleball, continue playing pickleball, and hope to see you out on the courts.
That's pro player Kevin Wong and HPR's Lillian Song. Wong is the first resident pickleball pro at the Wailai Country Club here on Oahu. He also teaches lessons for the Oahu Pickleball Association. And no date yet on when you might see him on national TV. Fun fact, pickleball got its start in 1965 in Washington State when a trio of families created a game using a badminton net, ping pong paddles, and a plastic wiffle ball to entertain their bored keiki. The name was inspired by the pickle boat, which is a rowing term when a last-minute crew is put together from rowers available at that time. Well, that does it for us today. Up tomorrow, we Hanaho stories about notable wahine as we wrap up Women's History Month. Give us some feedback. Call our talk back line, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Tell us about your love for pickleball or tennis. Find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else you tune in for podcasts. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.